why did you move away so far from conventional composing and making music? Like, I know that you're a trained pianist. And what did you make? You turned to soundscape and language, actually. First of all, human language.
Well, you know, I was a percussionist, and I had discovered the ensemble writing of John Cage and Lou Harrison, but also the speech chorus work of Ernst Toch and the other composers of the early 20th century. And it occurred to me that I could compose percussion music based on the sounds of speech as opposed to singing. And so I began to write quartets in which four people would be speaking in counterpoint, but not singing, you see. And it was non-pitched the way many percussion instruments are non-pitched. And so that began my interest in moving away from traditional composition and toward a kind of expression that was, in my world at the time, a radical departure. And I began to realize that there were so many others in other parts of the world who were doing the same thing. I had grown up rather isolated in Fresno, California, which is basically the breadbasket and the farming region of for fruits and vegetables in California and for much of the United States. So the Armenian community there was very large. The landscape was very much like what they had left in the Ottoman Empire 100 years earlier. And therefore, there was a kind of familiarity with that landscape. So, as I say, the isolation culturally was quite striking, and I had to discover things for myself. But the pivotal thing that happened was when I was 5 years old, my father bought a record of what he thought was Armenian folk music, and it turned out to be Maro Ajemian playing the prepared piano of John Cage, and Alan Hovhaness's music for piano and gongs and drums. And when my mother, who was a piano teacher, heard this, she told my father, please take it back to the store. We don't want that in our house. And he couldn't take it back because it was out of print, and they didn't accept it back. And so I loved this music, and whenever my mother would leave the house, I would put on these records. And I became very attracted to this idea of experimental music through those recordings. So that was another part. Being a percussionist, being a person involved in poetry and speech was really a part of all of that diversion away from traditional composition.
It's interesting to hear so many composers have this early adventure, this early experience of just listening to modern or avant-garde music. And I think kids are much more open to that and then don't make a difference between, like, music and noise, right?
That's right. And when I began to work in radio, the cycle became complete because at about the time I started in radio, which was 1969, we began to have inexpensive portable cassette machines. At that time, you had to be a professional radio announcer to have a Nagra or some machine that you could record ambient sounds with. But when the cassette machine came along, it changed everything, and I began to incorporate ambient sounds from all over the world into my compositions and to work with the Synclavier digital synthesizer to manipulate those sounds on a keyboard, which was the kind of instrument I was familiar with. So having all of those samples at my command on a keyboard was a great gift. And so the use of ambient sounds in my music came about. And of course, being familiar with Cage and his idea that anything is material for music didn't hurt either. And it gave me the impetus to listen all the time to everything, and to explore with the microphone, with my headphones on. So I would put the microphone close to a sound and then far away from a sound to see what the difference is. And so I was exploring for instruments. I was looking for things that could be musical material but weren't considered normally to be musical material.
So actually, it means as a composer, you're creating your own instruments, right? You're just recording environmental sounds, and then it's like an orchestral color, right?
That's correct. And when you have 40 of them blended together in and out, it's like a small chamber orchestra.
Right. You have a performance here, or one of your pieces. Actually, I don't know. Will you be around for the Ars Electronica?
Yes, I'm coming to be there, probably arriving around August 30th. But I do plan to be there. And I've been talking with Dennis Russell Davies about the Feldman piece. We've been thinking a lot about how to frame it. And although we might not do something with live Feldman music during the Ars Electronica Festival, we're thinking in the future to have some of Feldman's music performed in conjunction with the Tay piece.
That would be a fantastic idea. Can you tell us, or let's say the radio, the people who will listen to the piece on radio here in Kunstradio in Vienna, about your piece Loudspeakers? Some details you would be, that would be... you think that would be important for them to know?
The first thing that's important to know about Feldman in the context of what I have made with his voice is that he had a turn later in his career toward writing long pieces and pieces that involved repetition. So, in point of fact, what happened was that Feldman began his career by being very interested in short, very aphoristic pieces. For example, his influence from Webern was very profound. And so things were very truncated. And then later in life, he became consciously engaged in repetition, not so much in the manner of the minimalists, like Steve Reich and Philip Glass, but more in the manner of Hauer, an early 12-tone composer from Austria. And Joseph Matthias Hauer had a system of composition that involved using all 12 tones, but also using repetition in a very interesting way. He would play an arpeggio, and then he would play it again, and only one note would change. And then he would play it again, and only one note would change. I'm sure people in Austria are familiar with this. At least some people. His music is not played much today. But Feldman began to do this in his work. He would take a figure that was consisting of, let's say, 15 notes, and then he would do something where the voice leading is very smooth, and then he does it again where the voice leading is more disparate, and then he does it a third way where he makes it more dissonant. And then a fourth time where it's assembled in a way that there's no voice leading to speak of. And it's all the same material, and he is manipulating it over and over and over again. The effect is profoundly hypnotic. And so I tried to duplicate that in one of the movements of my composition in which he's speaking about that. So I also made this composition of Feldman's rather long, and I let him speak about what his thoughts were at the last part of his life. The interview was recorded in 1984, 3 years before he passed away at the age of 61. And so many of the references in this composition, in this particular tape piece using Feldman's voice, are to his later work. And there's a fantastic image at the end of the piece where he is in a performance of his music with Joan LaBarbera. And he's looking at Joan and the two loudspeakers on either side of Joan. And they have her pre-recorded voice on them. So there are three images of this singer. And he began to think that the loudspeakers looked like tombstones as he listened to the piece. And he was remembering that the words were by his friend, the poet Frank O'Hara, who had died. And he contemplated the image of Frank being dead, but everything sounds alive. And it began to remind him of the similarity between loudspeakers and tombstones. So I found that to be a really touching kind of reference, and I decided to end the composition with that reference.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful image in that piece. Thank you so much for this information. That's something I will be on air like that, I think. The second piece we'd like to play from you, and that's my last question for you, is the Pas de Vaux piece, the homage to Samuel Beckett.
Oh, right.
I'd love to put this piece also into the show in early September. I noticed that you mentioned that Beckett was not really very happy to hear his voice on tape, and what that was a reason for you not to. Was that the reason not to use his voice, or are there no any recordings of Samuel Beckett out?
Apparently there are no recordings of his voice and there are no motion pictures of him.
So you wouldn't even if you try, you wouldn't get any material from his voice?
That's correct.
Okay.
However, I did go to his apartment in Paris and I thought I could ring the doorbell and he would say something into the loudspeaker about who is it. And then I decided that would be unethical. Because he didn't want his voice recorded. He didn't want a cult of personality built around his image. And so he decided everybody should read his work, but they could only see his photograph. They didn't listen to him talk about his work.
So it was a matter of taste for you not to try to get a little material from
That's
him.
Right. Mm. And then the challenge became, because he was very cordial when he wrote me a postcard saying, good luck with your project, but I won't... want to participate in that way. I was encouraged to do it because of the kindness of this little postcard in the very tiny handwriting, like a little spider had written something to me. I decided that I would record the sounds outside his apartment building in Paris, and I went to the open-air metro stop across the street and recorded the sounds, and I looked up and I could see him in the window of his apartment building on the fifth floor, I think it was. And he was scribbling or writing some notes, and people were bringing him papers, and he was editing or writing. So I know that he heard the sounds I was hearing because they were so loud. There were soccer fans coming in, football fans coming in with air horns and screaming, and you couldn't miss how loud this was. So later that evening, I went to a dinner with a bunch of sound poets in Paris, and they told stories, and I included that. And then I went to the Centre Pompidou, and I recorded two young girls watching a mime act at the plaza near the fountain above IRCAM, the Digital Computer Music Center. And then I went to the Notre Dame Cathedral to the top and recorded the bells. And all of these sounds from the initial sound, which is a kind of farting sound, which is the first sound Beckett ever heard. When he was a child in a crib, he heard somebody at a dinner table, and that was the first sound he remembered. I started with that, and then I went through his life. The first part of the piece, by the way, has a long extended section that's very, very dry. There's hardly any sound at all, and that represents the time he locked himself in his room as a young man, away from his oppressive parents, and wouldn't come out for 3 months. And that was a very pivotal period of depression for him, and it made him decide to move to Paris and to adopt a new life. And so I thought it was important to include that as well.